From NPR News, this is Foreign Dispatch, a weekly roundup of some of the best coverage of news and events filed by NPR's correspondents from around the globe. I'm Kevin Beasley. This week, Japan still recovering from last year's disasters, Syrian rebels waiting for weapons, and Vladimir Putin is Russia's president again. It was a year ago that a powerful earthquake shook Japan and sent a devastating tsunami crashing onto its northeast coast. Today, many people in the region still face an uncertain future. Radiation continues to leak from the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear plant, which was badly damaged by the tsunami. Scientists say the amount of radioactive material being released now is not a significant threat. But as Diwali Zaikautau reports, the presence of contaminated soil and customers' fear of contaminated produce are making life particularly difficult for farmers.
That's the sound of decontamination in Fukushima Prefecture. Chiharu Kubota is using a high-pressure water gun to hose down a building in the mountain village of Kawauchi, which lies partly inside the area deemed unsafe because of high levels of radiation. Kubota has washed about 138 homes and is starting to see people return to Kawauchi. About 200 people are already back in the village, he says. But it's different, of course. Right now, only the elderly are here. No children have returned. Yoshiko Watanabe and her husband are farmers. They used to grow vegetables and sell them locally, but that ended after the earthquake. For 9 months, they lived in an evacuation center. Now they're home, but they can't farm because the soil is still contaminated. They're trying to get by on government handouts and some compensation from TEPCO, the owner of the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear plant.
Nothing is better, but I am here right now, so I feel happier compared to other people. I am alive.
Some 20 miles northwest in Nihonmatsu, the streets are also empty of children and activity. But along a city center walkway, one store is still open. But not many customers are responding to the traditional sweet potato song. And 75-year-old Hisa Ekano isn't doing much business.
So, this
area for the shops, of course, farmers and sightseeing, tourism, their business is all going down. So everything is bad because of the radiation.
Minoru Nemoto is the man in charge of radiation decontamination at Nihonmatsu City Hall. This is where farmers and worried consumers can bring vegetables and other food to get it tested for radioactivity.
Radiation is the biggest issue to be solved. Otherwise, people won't feel safe or comfortable living in Fukushima again. People have doubts about everything, and they're skeptical about anything they hear.
Nemoto says there are a lot of problems with the decontamination process, such as where to dispose of contaminated soil. He wants the government to come up with a more efficient approach so the land in Fukushima will be clean within 5 years. There's no sign of decontamination at Yoshiichi Takeda's small dairy farm. He says the government still won't let him feed grass to his cows because of possible contamination, but he has no idea when someone will come around to help clean up. Takeda has been promised some financial help, but he says it's like everything that he's been told by the government. It's just a promise. It's been a year since the disasters. He's received nothing yet. His neighbor, rice farmer Aiko Saito, says it's difficult for all the farmers around here.
Most of the people around this area lost a lot of money because of the radiation. Her kids don't eat what she grows, and people won't buy the vegetables and rice either.
Saito says she hasn't had officials check her produce for radiation recently, but her grandkids found low readings on their Geiger counters. So she's hoping life in Fukushima is starting to improve. For NPR News, I'm Dua Lee, so I kowtow in Nihonmatsu, Northeast Japan.
Coming up, Syrian rebels waiting for weapons, and Vladimir Putin is Russia's president again. This is Foreign Dispatch. I'm Kevin Beasley. As expected, Vladimir Putin emerged the winner in Russia's presidential election. As he reclaimed the presidency, Putin gave a fiery victory speech, angrily denouncing the protesters who in recent months have challenged his domination of Russian politics. Putin insisted that the voting was open and fair, but many independent observers say the election was riddled with violations. NPR's Corey Flintoff sent this report from Moscow.
With the Kremlin, Russia's citadel of power, at his back, Putin told a cheering crowd that they had won.
Мы победили!
We won in an open and honest battle, he said, repeating a campaign theme that cast the election as a war against foreign influence.
Мы показали, что...
We showed that no one can impose anything on us, he said. No one, nothing. We showed that our people can distinguish between the desire for renewal and a political provocation that has only one goal, destroy Russian statehood and usurp power. It was a harsh rebuff to the tens of thousands of people who've taken to the streets in Moscow and other big cities in recent months to demand fair elections. Dmitry Trenin, director of the Carnegie Moscow Center, says the speech may have been a release of Putin's tension over that challenge.
Mr. Putin must have been truly worried that dark forces out there in the United States, I think, working through their agents in Russia, who were trying to topple him.
Trenin says the vehemence with which the Russian leader delivered that speech shows that Putin must believe that the protests against him were at least partly the work of the U.S. State Department. Three times during his speech, Putin insisted that his victory had been honest or clean, an apparent effort to preempt widespread complaints of election fraud. The election was probably the most thoroughly monitored in Russia's history. Opposition groups recruited and trained tens of thousands of volunteer poll watchers, and the government installed web cameras at polling places. But the independent election watchdog group Golos reported more than 3,700 complaints of voting violations. One of the most common complaints was of so-called carousel voting, in which operatives are driven from one polling place to another using absentee ballot forms to cast multiple votes. But Putin's support is strong in many places among people who say they've seen their lives improve. Outside a polling station in central Moscow, Igor Smoly and his wife Yelena said proudly that they voted for Putin. He's a 40-year-old military officer, she's 36, and a kindergarten teacher. They're a good-looking, well-dressed couple who stand arm-in-arm and finish each other's sentences. They have three children, Yelena says, and it was a lot more of a financial struggle to raise the first one before Putin came to power than it was with the children who came afterward. That, they say, was a result of Putin's policies. At the same polling place, though, people also registered their opposition to Putin. Larissa Kirilenko, a 52-year-old businesswoman, is here with her 30-year-old son, Sergei, a manager in a trading company. She says she cast a protest vote in favor of the marginal candidate, Vladimir Zhirinovsky, but that she'd rather cast a vote that would assure a better future for her son. I want to know what sort of country he'll be living in, she says, so that he won't have to leave the country with his good education. Sergei himself says he spoiled his ballot so that it wouldn't count because he didn't like any of the candidates on the list. Putin's fiery victory speech may be stirring deeper divisions between people like the Smolys and the Kirilenkos. It could also herald a harsher crackdown on the opposition members who say they want to keep pressure on the government for fair elections and other reforms. The opposition is planning a protest in the capital this evening. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Moscow.
Syrians, fleeing the army's assault on rebel-held areas of the country, are arriving in Lebanon and Turkey with tales of horrific shelling of civilian areas and the summary execution of the government's opponents. Some countries have been talking about arming the rebels, but opposition fighters say despite the talk, there's been very little sign of imported weapons reaching them. NPR's Peter Kenyon sent this report from the Turkish-Syrian border.
It's a clear and piercingly cold night on a desolate dirt road just yards from Syria. A small knot of visitors shivers and strains to hear the sound of Syrian refugees negotiating a shallow river. It's their last obstacle before reaching refuge in Turkey. On this night, as it happens, a Turkish army patrol pulls up just as the Syrians appear and herds them onto a truck for the trip to a nearby camp. The waiting journalists won't get these stories tonight, but a few more Syrian families will be putting their children to bed in a safe place for the first time in a long while. In a nondescript apartment room on the Turkish side of the border, clouds of cigarette smoke drift toward the ceiling as opposition activists ponder how to keep people and supplies moving across the border. Abu Jafar is the assumed name of a Syrian smuggler who's been dodging army patrols for the past several months. He says they're still getting back and forth, but the Syrian army has begun occupying whole villages to block their path, and they have to be very careful when villages rise up in protest, because that attracts the security forces. In Arab and Western capitals, the talk has been of a pro-reform uprising turning into an armed insurgency. Washington accuses Iran of supporting the regime's crackdown, while Damascus claims that the Saudis, Americans, and Israelis are already covertly arming what it calls the armed gangs opposing it. For Captain Ayham al-Kurdi, a Free Syrian Army officer, this debate might as well be taking place on another planet. He's heard of mysterious arms deliveries from Qatar or Saudi Arabia, but says he only knows of the usual piecemeal smuggling, a few guns at a time.
At first, we got weapons from battling the army. Then Lebanon helped with light weapons for a while. But then the Syrian army and Hezbollah started to block that route. If people want to know where our guns come from now, they're mostly from Syria itself.
Lebanese activists say their supply lines are in fact still open, and more weapons are getting across that frontier than anywhere else, but even there the traffic is sporadic. As for acquiring arms inside Syria, a veteran activist operating in southern Turkey named Abu Ismail says it's not surprising that there are plenty of Syrians willing to sell guns to the opposition.
From what I hear, they need almost everything, but they can easily get guns inside. The regime spent 40 years building a deeply corrupt country, and now they can pay the price.
Abu Ismail is a soft-spoken, stocky man from the northern town of Jisr al-Shughur. He sees the divisions within the Syrian opposition and ongoing international indecision as a recipe for humanitarian disaster.
By now, the world knows what's going on, and still nothing happens. Perhaps you could try looking at us as human beings instead of pieces in a political game that will help or hurt other countries like Israel. Just find some way to help us before it's too late.
For 18-year-old Mohammed Ibrahim, the uprising has ended in a Turkish hospital bed. Mohammed's dark, slightly haunted eyes peer out from an unlined face as he explains how he ran to help victims of an artillery shelling in a village near Hama when another shell shattered his right leg, leaving him to crawl over body parts to escape. Mohammed was proud of his contribution to the uprising. He was the singer at his village's demonstrations, keeping the crowd's spirits up as they defied the might of the army. The stump of his leg twitches as he sings, "My country is a paradise, even when it's hell. Hama, please forgive us." The song vows to avenge the deaths of martyrs and liberate Syria from the treacherous Bashar. Like the opposition so far, the song doesn't specify how that might be achieved. Peter Kenyon, NPR News, near the Turkey-Syria border.
For more international coverage, you can listen to your local NPR station. You'll find a list at our website, npr.org. And while you're there, you can find more international stories by clicking on News and World. For NPR News, I'm Kevin Beasley.